From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the story we all hoped Terry Anderson would live to tell, the story of his years in captivity. Anderson was the longest-held American hostage in the Middle East. He was the Associated Press Middle East correspondent when he was kidnapped in Lebanon. His fiancée, Madeleine Basile, was pregnant with their child. Anderson and Basile have collaborated on a memoir about the 7 years he was held hostage. We'll talk with them both. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews Smilla's Sense of Snow, the new thriller by Danish writer Peter Hoag. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Rebels in the Russian parliament surrendered today after government troops and paratroops blasted the parliament building with artillery and heavy machine gun fire. Parliament Speaker Ruslan Hasbulatov and Vice President Alexander Rutskoy were taken from the building to a high-security prison. The military imposed a curfew on the capital city and continued to search for holdouts in the 19-story parliament building. Russian President Boris Yeltsin shut down several opposition newspapers and banned a number of nationalist and communist political parties. Western leaders were quick to give their support to Yeltsin today. European ministers echoed the endorsement of President Bill Clinton and promised more financial help in a meeting in Luxembourg. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from London.
As European foreign ministers assembled for a scheduled meeting to discuss more trade ties with Moscow, the television pictures of Russian tanks firing on the parliament building were broadcast to an uneasy worldwide audience. Even before the smoke cleared, European commissioners said the Russian president, Boris Yeltsin, deserves strong support. They blamed Yeltsin's opponents for provoking today's violence and promised more substantial help. There was a pledge of a plane load of medical supplies requested by the Yeltsin government. The commissioners said they would speed up an important trade agreement designed to stimulate the economy, and there was talk of rescheduling a summit for next month with Yeltsin, all designed to boost his prestige at home. In London this morning, Russia's ambassador had asked the British Prime Minister, John Major, for more open support for the Russian leader. He got that and more. The events in Moscow spurred European governments to back the man they hope can deliver stability in Russia, and from there, a market democracy. In London, this is Deborah Amos.
A nonprofit group, the American Health Foundation, has issued a report card measuring the health of U.S. children. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports the overall grade is below average.
The health watchdog group gives the U.S. a C- for its treatment of children's health issues, the same grade it gave last year. It faults schools and lawmakers for failing to require that children are educated, starting as early as kindergarten, about the dangers of things like smoking, drug and alcohol abuse, and the use of firearms. Dr. Bill Friedwell says all physicians, not just pediatricians, must also take a greater interest in guarding children's health.
They should become advocates of children's health in multiple contexts. One is on the national level or politically, but that also needs to be extended perhaps even more appropriately at the community level and in the schools.
The American Health Foundation is calling for yearly screening of children beginning in preschool to chart both their current health and behaviors that could affect it down the road. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 3 points to close at 3,578. This is NPR. Defense Secretary Les Aspin said today that he will not force the resignation of the nation's top naval officer. Navy Secretary John Dalton had recommended that Admiral Frank Kelso be fired for allegedly showing a lack of leadership in dealing with the Tailhook sexual abuse scandal. Aspin's decision apparently means that Kelso will be allowed to retire as scheduled next July. Admiral Kelso attended the 1991 Tailhook Convention, at which 83 women were alleged to be sexually harassed or abused by drunken Navy and Marine Corps pilots. Kelso was never accused of taking part in the attacks or even knowing about them, but Dalton argued that Kelso should be held responsible as the senior officer at the time. One of the Los Angeles police officers convicted in the Rodney King beating will have to begin serving his prison sentence next week. The Supreme Court rejected Lawrence Powell's request to remain free on bail while his conviction is being appealed. NPR's Ina Jaffe has a report.
Lawrence Powell was to have begun serving his 2.5-year sentence last week, but federal judge John Davies signed a delay order allowing Powell and Los Angeles Police Sergeant Stacy Kuhn to remain free while the Supreme Court was considering their request. Powell and Kuhn were convicted last April of violating Rodney King's civil rights during the 1991 beating. Their attorneys have argued that the two men should be allowed to remain free on bail while their convictions are appealed because they pose no threat to society and because they could serve their entire sentences only to have their convictions later overturned by a higher court. These arguments were rejected by the district and appeals courts and now in the case of Lawrence Powell by the Supreme Court, which ruled without comment. The Supreme Court has not yet ruled in the case of Sergeant Stacy Kuhn. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
Construction spending fell 1.1% in August, dropping for the first time in 4 months. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I remember, as you probably do, watching Terry Anderson's first press conference after his years in captivity. Anderson was the longest-held Western hostage in Lebanon. We all wondered during his captivity about what happens to a human being when he spends the better part of 7 years blindfolded and chained to a wall. Who would have believed one could maintain such grace, eloquence, and clear-sightedness? Anderson was the Middle East correspondent for the Associated Press when he was kidnapped in Beirut on March 16, 1985. His captors were Muslim fundamentalists who described themselves as members of the Islamic Jihad. His fiancée, Madeleine Basile, was 6 months pregnant when he was captured. Now they are married and live with their daughter in a suburb of New York City. Anderson and Basile have co-authored a book called Den of Lions, Memoirs of 7 Years. When I spoke with them, Anderson told me he's still determined to forgive his captors, and he thinks he's making progress.
It's something that you work on fairly often every time you think about it, and probably will go on for a long time. But it's something that we have to do for two reasons. We're Christians and we're required to, and because I'm not going to let it affect my life. If I stay angry, if I stay bitter over what happened, it's not going to hurt them. It's only going to hurt me and the people around me. I have a very good life right now. I'm very happy right now. I don't want that to be harmed in any way.
You wrote that you sometimes wondered if your captors thought you were a human being. How do you think your guards rationalized your captivity?
I don't know, really. We talked, and there were things that we could understand a bit about each other, but there was always a limit. There was always a point that you reached and said, you know, I simply can't understand this. These are very religious people. These are people who pray 5 times a day. They're fundamentalist Muslims. I've read the Quran. I know something about Islam. There's no place in Islam that I can find that justifies that kind of treatment of another human being. I can't understand how anyone who believes, as they do, in a merciful and compassionate God can possibly believe that kidnapping and murder are pleasing to that merciful and compassionate God. You can't understand.
Did they seem scared, too?
Yeah, some of them were pretty scared. They were young men. What they were doing was dangerous. They are not frontline soldiers. I can't say that they're very courageous. It doesn't take a great deal of courage to kidnap unarmed people and chain them to the wall. So, they were scared. They were scared of us, quite often.
What were they afraid that you could do to them?
Well, we were all much larger than they were. They were relatively small young men, and they were scared that we would do something violent. Every time you moved quickly, you could see them jump. And for quite a long time.
Did you consider it? Did you consider doing
that?
Sure,
of course we considered it. Of course we did. I decided against it. I thought it was foolish.
Why?
I was chained. Uh-huh. Suppose I grabbed a guard, took his gun, and shot him. What am I going to do then? Uh-huh. Rip my chain out of the wall? There were times when I thought there might have been a chance, but I waited and rejected it. I didn't want to get killed. And had I managed to throttle a guard, and I would have had probably to kill one to get away, which meant, of course, that I had better get away. And gotten through the locks on the doors, if we didn't happen to be chained at that particular moment, can you imagine what would have happened to a very pale-skinned white male running down the street in a pair of white boxer shorts in the middle of a fundamentalist Shiite neighborhood?
That's an interesting image.
I didn't think there was any real chance to escape, so I didn't try. Had there been a chance, I'd have been gone, believe me.
You know, and yet you ask yourself in the book, you know, have we, the hostages, been tamed? Have we become meek, well-mannered little hostages? Are we accepting this assault on our dignity? Did you ask yourself a lot and wonder, like, is it a bad thing that you're doing what you're told and that
sure.
you're
Look,
following
it's always,
the orders and accepting it? Yeah.
It's always a challenge to your manhood. And different things challenged each of us more directly or more intimately. You always had to ask yourself, when I talk to these young men reasonably, when I treat them like normal human beings, when I'm reasonably polite, is that giving in? Should I show them how angry I am? Should I show them how much I hate what they're doing? Should I be hostile? Brian Keenan was always hostile.
He's the one who was supposed to have the great sense of humor.
Oh, he did. But he could never bring himself to deal with these people in any way except, I hate you and I want you to know I hate you. He would occasionally try to keep relations on a reasonable basis, but he just couldn't bring himself to do it. He's a Irishman with a temper and a nationalist. And in Northern Ireland, the way they conceive of dealing with your enemy is with open defiance. And that's what he did, and he paid for it. He paid dearly for it.
With punishment?
Oh, yes. He was severely beaten many, many times.
Were you beaten a lot?
Not a lot. I was thumped around the first year and a half or so, and then they stopped. I don't know why they did, because they continued to assault some of the others. But they left me alone.
You said everybody had the thing that most challenged their manhood. What was that thing for you?
The worst thing was not reacting, not leaping to the defense of Brian when he was beaten, chained and taped and beaten beside me. I was chained also. There isn't anything I really could have done. And we knew by then that the best reaction when they went into these rages, which they did from time to time, was just to curl up and wait it out. Because if you defied them, they just went further over the wall and you could get seriously hurt. Whereas if you offered no resistance, they would eventually stop. But to lie there and listen to a close friend and companion being beaten while you do nothing, even if you know it's the right thing to do, is a pretty disgusting, humiliating experience.
Did you watch or did you look away?
I was blindfolded.
Oh, sure.
You couldn't watch. But you could hear.
Did you say anything? You said nothing.
Not during the beating. Afterward, we went on a hunger strike, all of us. Demanded that they remove the guard who did the beating.
Did they care that you were on a hunger strike?
Oh, sure.
Why?
They didn't want us to get sick and die. We were valuable to them.
Uh-huh.
It worked for a while. After a while, you know, the third or fourth time we did it, then didn't work all that well. But it always bothered them enough so that we could get the attention of some leader or some chief, which was the point, of course.
Terry, let me bring your wife, Madeline Basile, into our conversation. Madeline, welcome.
Thank you.
You hadn't known each other very long before the kidnapping.
That's right.
You had met, fallen in love, planned to marry, but Terry, you were still going through a divorce, so you couldn't marry just yet.
Mm-hmm.
So your relationship was still pretty new. Did you, Madeline, have faith that your relationship would endure this kind of trial, assuming that Terry lived?
Yes, of course. That's why I'm here today. From the beginning, when Terry and I met and dated, I was a 16-year-old girl. I was in my 35th year. So by that time, I really knew what I wanted and who I wanted in life, in my life forever. So when I said yes to Terry, I meant yes forever, for better and worse, although we weren't married.
Not quite that worse.
Well, what happened was bad. So, yes, I had faith that we will be together forever. And of course, not knowing that this was going to come in our lives.
Madeline, you write in the book that there were times you thought that you wanted a man in your life and your daughter needed a father, and you thought, should I have other relationships? And you decided no.
It was difficult to decide no, to be frankly with you. It wasn't easy because we weren't married, so we had our word to each other. I decided no for many reasons, but I must say the most important reason is Sulome, our daughter, and then Terry. I knew it would hurt him if I did. At the same time, I knew he would understand, but I knew it would hurt him, and I couldn't get myself to do it when he's where he is. I knew he was suffering. It just was very difficult, and I could never imagine another man in Solomon's life, although I wanted and needed it badly, but I couldn't just go ahead and do it. Not as long as him and I have... are still keeping the promise to each other. I was never going to do it.
My guests are Terry Anderson and his wife, Madeline Basile. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Terry Anderson and Madeline Basile, and they've written a memoir of Terry Anderson's 7 years of captivity. It's called Den of Lions. Terry, I want to ask you, when during the 7 years that you were held hostage, how much of that time were you chained to the wall?
We were chained the first 4.5 months, and then we were put in a place where they did not keep us on a chain. They merely kept locks on the doors. There were several of us in the room for a year. Then we went to another basement cell, where the cells were only 6 feet square and 6 feet high, so we hardly needed a chain. We were put on chains again in January 1987, when Terry Waite was kidnapped. And we remained chained from January of 1987 until December of 1991. So
there were 4 years in a row of being chained.
We were never off the chain, except to go to the bathroom, 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
And the last 2 weeks.
The last 2 weeks they took the chains off, that's right.
Did you have your choice of which leg was chained?
Yeah, it depended. You sometimes would have the choice of whether your ankle was chained or whether your wrist was chained, or which foot you'd put it on. Sometimes you wouldn't, depended on where we were.
How would you choose?
Oh, ankle's better than wrist, no problem.
Why is the ankle better?
Well, because you can stand up, you can take 2 paces in each direction if it's a 5-foot chain. If it's on your wrist, then you can't walk and you can't stand up. They chained my wrist there for 1.5 years with Tom. And that was 1.5 years you couldn't stand up.
Wow. What happened to your legs during that period?
I got pretty weak. I got fat, actually, because they were giving us a lot of rice and stuff. And I put on weight.
That must have felt really odd, gaining weight.
It felt very odd. We didn't have very much to do except eat whatever they gave us.
So what did you do for your legs when you were able to walk again?
Well, we went to another prison where they gave us 30 minutes of exercise each morning. and I would jog back and forth across the room. And then when they put us back on the chain, I did a lot of exercises then to try to get my strength back. I got some of it back, but I was still awfully weak when I was released. Weaker than I thought.
How are your legs and arms now?
I'm in pretty good shape. I jog most mornings and have a set of weights and I do some weightlifting. I'm in fair shape.
There was at least one of the cells where you had a really bad problem with mice and cockroaches and spiders.
Oh, we had cockroaches all the time.
Yeah.
But the basement prison was pretty awful. Conditions were bad and there was a lot of wildlife around.
Did you ever get used to that? Do the vermin ever start to bother you any less?
The roaches always were kind of disgusting. And the mice and the rats didn't bother me very much. But I have a phobia about spiders. I don't like spiders. I never have. Other sorts of animals and bugs don't bother me very much. And there was a period when I decided that I was gonna get over my phobia, so I let all these spiders build their webs in my cell. And they were all over the place in all the corners and off the walls and things. A couple of dozen of them, different sizes. And I'd stand up and look at them from 3 inches away. And that lasted a few days, and then I got up and killed them all at once. I said, I'm going to live with my phobia.
Oh, man. So do you still have a spider phobia?
I still don't like spiders. I don't like them. I just don't like them.
Wow. So what did it feel like when you killed all the spiders in the cell?
It's quite satisfying. Kept a mouse for a while. Fed a mouse. Used to come out.
Kept him as a little pet?
Yeah, but he went away.
Feed him the spiders?
Yeah.
You read the Bible a lot inside.
I did indeed.
But you write that you'd actually been becoming more Catholic before you became a hostage, that you were already starting to, like, rethink your faith and to, become more involved with your faith after having left the religion.
I rejoined the church. That's not strictly exactly right, because I was always a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
It was just for a long time during my life. I denied that and rejected it, and what happened was I simply accepted it again as a fact. I'm a Catholic. I'm a Christian. This is what I believe, and that means I'm going to have to do certain things. And I was trying to figure out exactly what those things might be.
You write that you found it hard to believe in a God who cares endlessly and each moment about every one of us, who monitors our every deed and guides all things. How did your understanding of God change during the years that you were a hostage and you were reading the Bible?
I'm not a theologian, and I learned that such things are not necessary for me to understand. I cannot balance the idea of an omnipotent and all-merciful God with the presence of evil in the world. It's a question that theologians have been struggling with for centuries, and I'm certainly not going to answer it. I ceased to think such things were important. The God I believe in is a very personal one. And that's the important part.
When Father Jenko was taken hostage, you asked to say confession to him, and the guards kind of reluctantly let you do it. Did you try to make that as meaningful a confession as possible? I mean, was this just a way to talk with him, or did you really want it to be the real thing, a real confession which you hadn't made in many years?
It was the real thing. It was extremely meaningful. Look, much of the Catholic faith involves ritual. I like that. I'm comfortable with it. Obviously, the core of the faith is very personal and has to do with a belief in God, but the ritual is there for a reason. And it's a lovely thing, and at times it serves very strong purposes. That's true with confession, certainly, with formal confession. I felt a need to talk to my confessor, the only one who was handy. It was a very emotional time. It was very necessary for me at that particular time. It was very meaningful.
It's kind of interesting, you in the position of, you know, innocent victim confessing your sins.
Well, there were quite a few that needed confessing.
There was one point where the guard said that one of you, one of the hostages, and I think there were five of you in the room then, were going to be released.
Mm-hmm.
And the group of hostages was asked to choose which one it was going to be. What an awkward position. And you suggested yourself as the
one. Well, everybody wanted to go home.
Yeah.
And that was the starting point. Everybody deserved to go home.
Mm-hmm.
And the question that was put to us, we need somebody, we're going to let somebody go, and his job is going to go out and be a spokesman and try to persuade the government to negotiate, to begin negotiations. And the choice was, you know, who do we think we should send to do that? And we had discussion and had a vote, and they chose me, and it was all a joke.
What was all a joke?
Well,
you mean because they didn't respect that anyway?
Well, they had never intended to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very cruel hoax. Ben Weir went home in the end, which was proper and correct. Ben Weir being the longest held and the oldest, and he should have gone home.
What was it like for you to feel that you would be the best representative and to vote for yourself, knowing that, you know, on some level one should be...
That's not quite how it worked out.
Yeah, let me let you explain that.
Father Martin and Ben Weir both eliminated themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They said they didn't want to go. And the chief said that Tom Sutherland could not be the one chosen. He was eliminated by them. We discussed it and we said, well, we're just going to ignore their strictures. We will... If we're going to choose, we'll choose who we believe we should choose, whether it's Father Martin or Ben Weir or Tom or anybody else. And then we put our choices down on a piece of paper, secret ballot kind of thing. And the first time everybody voted for somebody else, and it came out, everybody got a vote. And then the second time... Well, it came out there were about five ballots, and it came down to David and I. And I voted for myself. So did David. In the end, it finally came down to unanimous choice on me. It was a very, very difficult time. And I don't know, what can I tell you? It was very hard.
How did you feel when the guards came back after you were voted the one to be released? The guards came back and said, "No, it can't be Terry Anderson."
Okay, how do you imagine I felt? I had prepared myself for that. I thought, but it was still a very great shock, because when something like that happens, no matter how you try not to believe something or try to say this is not going to happen the way you expect, you still do believe it in yourself. So it was a great disappointment. Of course it was a great shock.
Terry Anderson and Madeline Basile collaborated on the new memoir, Den of Lions. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More on the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, more with Terry Anderson about his 7 years in captivity. And we'll talk more with his wife, Madeline Basile, who decided not to speak to the press while Anderson was held hostage. And book critic John Leonard reviews Smilla's Sense of Snow, a new thriller by Danish writer Peter Hoag. It's the first of his novels to be translated to English. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton has stated his support once again for Russian President Boris Yeltsin in Yeltsin's ongoing confrontation with the Russian parliament. NPR's Mara Eliason reports from San Francisco.
At a trade union convention in San Francisco to push two domestic initiatives, his health care reform plan and the ratification of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, President Clinton's pitch was overshadowed by events exploding around the world. He repeated his firm support for Boris Yeltsin's decision to use military force against the parliament in Moscow.
I have, as of this moment, absolutely no reason to doubt the personal commitment that Boris Yeltsin made to let the Russian people decide their own future. To secure a new constitution with democratic values and democratic processes, to have a new legislative branch elected with democratic elections, and to subject himself yet again to a democratic vote of the people. That is all that we can ask.
Later, Clinton spoke even more forcefully in support of Yeltsin, insisting that the Russian president had bent over backwards to avoid a military confrontation and had possibly waited too long before he ordered Russian troops to move in. In San Francisco, I'm Mara Liasson.
In Moscow, the leaders of the armed uprising have now been taken into custody and the revolt appears to be over. From Moscow, Robert Parsons reports for the BBC.
Russia's second October revolution this century appears to be petering out. The surrender of the rebels, a mixture of soldiers and civilians, means the government troops are left now with the task of mopping up the last pockets of rebel resistance. That may take some time. Even as the surrender was taking place, small arms fire rang out at the back of the parliament building. According to a presidential aide, the rebel leaders, Mr. Rutskoy and Mr. Khasbulatov, have been taken to a place of safety and could soon face legal proceedings. The foreign minister of Luxembourg, Jacques Pousse, said the two men had appealed to the European community to guarantee their safety, and Mr. Yeltsin had promised they wouldn't be harmed.
Robert Parsons reporting from Moscow for the BBC. Also in Moscow, Russian leader Boris Yeltsin has banned a number of opposition groups in the wake of yesterday's violence. Earlier today, the Russian leader suspended a number of communist publications. According to Moscow news reports, the presidential order was made under terms of a state of emergency declared last night by Yeltsin after what was termed proof that the banned parties had violated rights and exceeded their authorities and taken part in unrest. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 3 points to close at 3,577.76 on volume of 226 million shares. Trading again today was heavy. This is NPR News. In Somalia, military officials say at least 12 U.S. soldiers have been killed and at least one has been taken prisoner in efforts to destroy command headquarters of fugitive factional leader General Adid. Officials say that 78 U.S. soldiers were wounded in the fighting. In the face of rising criticism of U.S. policy in Somalia, a State Department spokesman said that the Clinton administration is firmly committed to its mission there. New fighting occurred on the second day of a major U.N. drive to wipe out Adid's military command structure. Some lawmakers say that they want U.S. soldiers out of Somalia because they have become targets there. Critics charge that UN forces have changed their aim from providing aid to hunting down Adid. Admiral Frank Kelso says that he is pleased with Defense Secretary Les Aspin's decision to keep him on as Chief of Naval Operations. Aspen rejected the advice of the new civilian Secretary of the Navy, John Dalton, to fire Kelso. NPR's Martha Raddatz has that story.
Admiral Kelso said he never offered Secretary Aspen his resignation despite Dalton's recommendation. The admiral says he wanted to continue to serve and felt he should continue to serve. Secretary Aspen apparently feels the same way. He sent back Dalton's report saying there was not enough evidence to suggest that Kelso be asked to retire. Admiral Kelso left the Pentagon tonight a happy man.
I'm certainly pleased that I will continue to serve this great Navy as its CNO. I appreciate the confidence that's been shown in me to continue to serve. Secretary Dalton and I have forged a partnership, and we will work closely together.
The admiral says he does not believe Dalton's recommendation will create any credibility problems, although it is now widely known that the secretary and the admiral were at odds. I'm Martha Raddatz at the Pentagon.
This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of an interview with Terry Anderson and his wife, Madeline Basile. Anderson was the longest-held Western hostage in Lebanon. He was released after 7 years, on December 4, 1991. Anderson and Basile have collaborated on a memoir about his years in captivity. It's called Den of Lions. What were the times when you were most afraid of losing your sanity?
Oh, there were a few times when I thought I was going to lose it. There was a time when I began to lose it and began beating my head against the wall. Beat it bloody, and they had to pull me down and chain me up again. There were one or two others. There was a time in solitary confinement for a while in a very bad place. No lights, and no books or anything in the cell. When I thought I was going to lose it, I was going crazy. But it ended, and I managed to get through. That's a strange thing, you know. I keep coming back to this. Terry Waite spent 3.5 years in solitary confinement with no other input, no books, nothing, no contact with anybody, nothing to think about, only his head. And when he joined us, he was sane. I spent less than a year in solitary confinement altogether, and it nearly destroyed me. And different things affect men differently.
When you were beating your head against the wall during that period, did you have any idea what you were doing?
I was just trying to make it stop. The thoughts in my head were going round and round and round, and I felt I was losing control of my own brain, and I was just trying to make it stop.
What kind of thoughts were going around?
Oh, lots of crazy thoughts.
During the 7 years that you were held hostage, did you ever see your face in a mirror?
Once in a while. Not very often, actually, because for some reason, the guards would remove the mirrors from the bathrooms. Sometimes we'd stay in an apartment, like a regular apartment, and they would put steel sheets over the windows and put in a special metal plate over the door and chain us to the wall. But then when they'd take us to the bathroom, it'd be a regular apartment bathroom. Maybe the window would be covered over. But they always took the mirror off.
I wonder why.
Well, we speculated about that. We thought because when we were in the bathroom, we were allowed to lift our blindfold to see what we were doing. And I think they were afraid that as they were standing behind us or in the doorway or when they came in to get us, we would see them in the mirror.
Right.
That's the best explanation we could come up with. Toward the end, they were a little less strict about that, and, you know, if we asked, they would bring us a hand mirror so we could trim our hair or something.
I wonder what it was like to really see yourself in a good mirror again.
We look pretty awful, I gotta tell you.
Does it affect your sense of who you are to not have a sense of what you look like? I mean, you don't have to be vain to pass mirrors all the time and just have a sense of who you physically are.
Oh, it's a bit annoying having to shave without a mirror. It never bothered me too much. I was sometimes curious about what I'd look like. There was a period there, I guess, when it was lucky we couldn't see a mirror. Some of the pictures they released were pretty awful.
Yeah.
They must have scared people.
Well, I want to ask you about those pictures. You know, like, did you actually pose for any of those pictures that were released?
Well, I mean, they'd when they wanted pictures, they'd come in and they'd say, stand up, and they'd put you against a, generally hang a blanket or something so nobody could tell where we were, and take off your blindfold and shoot a picture and put your blindfold back on and put you back on a chain.
Did you do things to try to convey secret messages to people who would see it through the expression on your face?
No. One of the videotapes I made was really silly. One of the more paranoid of the leaders accused me of doing that. I've been a broadcaster, a newsman, so I have, you know, a couple of those habits, like putting your hands someplace and holding them very still, or sitting very still. Or at least I used to. And they had me make this tape, and I took the script and put it as you do when you're reading the newscast. Put my hands on either side, sat up straight, and I very carefully would move each page as I read it. And after we were done, the guy accused me of making signals because I was not acting naturally. And he was quite paranoid, and he made me do the whole thing over again. But no, we never tried to send signals in that way. I always insisted when I made those tapes that they allow me to speak directly to my family, at least briefly. And they did.
Did you want to look as good as possible or as bad as possible?
Whew, I never thought really about that too much. I did not want to scare anybody. I did not want my family to think that our circumstances were terrible.
But you did.
But yeah, it must have scared people.
Yeah.
Well, Madeline, what would you think when you saw the photos as they were released in the videos?
Well, I'd go through a whole analysis about the way he looks, what he's trying to tell us, how badly he feels. His eyes looks this way, and all sorts of thoughts, hoping that that the look of anger in his face is because he's angry. And because he's reacting to his imprisonment, the fact that he is angry, he is Terry, and he's not giving up, he's not, they're not breaking him. So in a way, although they were very scary, but they were, believe it or not, to me they were, some of them were really encouraging that he is not giving up. Or has not given up. So, but you'd go through all sorts of thoughts and hopes and disappointments just from a picture.
My guests are Terry Anderson and his wife, Madeline Basile. They've collaborated on the new memoir, Den of Lions. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Terry Anderson and Madeline Basile. Madeline, you wrote that you were afraid you were losing your mind during part of the captivity and that you'd really let yourself go. There were 5 months when you washed your hair, but you wouldn't comb it.
Yeah.
Were you almost like afraid to allow yourself to have pleasures because you knew Terry was being deprived of everything?
Oh, yeah. That was in my mind all the time. I was afraid, I mean, in a way, that I've lost even my womanhood in my mind. I would try my best to look as worse, as bad as I can.
Why?
I don't know, you know, I really don't know. It's psychological, I suppose. Here I am, out, free. I don't know. You can say maybe it's the way I was brought up, maybe it's in my culture.
Like it's just guilt.
It's guilt. It's a lot of guilt. Even if I didn't do anything, and
guilt for seeing someone you love suffer when you're not suffering.
I wanted to stay as psychologically and law, if you know what I mean. I wanted to stay hurt while he's there because I just couldn't be happy. I couldn't let myself be happy. The one thing I feel very sorry about, and I regret today, but there was nothing I could do about it, is the fact that I really don't feel I have enjoyed my daughter as I would have wished myself as a mother to do. I was with her, I did my best to give her a normal life, but now I know I really didn't enjoy her because I was unhappy all the time.
Terry, can I ask you how it felt? Forgive me for asking, but what did it feel like when you got your freedom?
Well, you can imagine what it felt like. I mean, it was an enormous joy. I was really kind of on a high for a long time. I still am, actually.
Yeah, does that last? I've always wondered if that lasts or if this incredible depression sets in afterwards when you realize what's been taken away.
Hasn't been any depression. There have been some difficult times. We've had some adjustments to make and we've had to work on some things, but no, I've never been depressed about it.
I think the fact that we were lucky to go away the first 3-4 months.
And to get away from all the attention.
Exactly, mm-hmm. And start a family life away before the attention came, before he was exposed to all the media and in the world. I think that was good.
Yeah. Terry, to write the memoir, you asked for your Freedom of Information Act files. You had a great article about this in the New York Times a while back where you said that you were afraid it would take more time for you to get your files and than you spent held hostage. Did you learn anything that really surprised you from what you did get in the files and from what came back uncensored?
Zero.
Zero?
Zip. Uh-huh. I have yet to obtain a single useful or interesting fact out of all the stuff they've sent me. 80% of the stuff they're sending me under the Freedom of Information Act is news stories.
like from newspapers?
That have been declassified, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I don't know who classified them in the first place, but I got a stack of AP stories that somebody thought was worth putting in somebody's secret file. I've gotten nothing useful. I have turned over all... I'm still getting material, and I will for years, because I've turned over all my requests and appeals of those requests to National Security Archives, which is a group of people who have pro bono lawyers in Washington, and this is what they do.
Yeah, this is their specialty.
They mm-hmm. pursue freedom of information requests on behalf of people who don't have time or resources to do it, and then they put all the information that they get into a data bank, which everybody has access to. That's how I got Ali North's diaries. They had pursued a long, difficult legal battle to get Ali's diaries, and then I went there and they gave them to me for my book.
Speaking of Ali North, how did you feel when you found out about the arms for hostages deal?
Oh, well, I think it was a mistake, and we thought so in there. We thought it was a bad deal. It didn't work. They got 3 hostages released, and they got a bunch more captured. I told Ali North that when I met him, by the way. I interviewed him several times. I like Ali North. I like him personally. He's a very personable man. He's a warm man. And there's no question whatsoever that he, as well as Ronald Reagan and George Bush and all the other people involved, were personally dedicated to getting us out. I mean, they really cared about us. Ronald Reagan cared so much that he ignored the strongest sort of advice from his top advisors, who said, "Mr. President, you can't do this." And he said, "I don't care. I want them out." These people really cared about what they were doing, and I can hardly criticize him for that. I think they...
You're not cynical about their motives for wanting the hostages, really?
No,
not the motives, no.
No, not the motives. I think they made some bad judgments, mm-hmm. and they certainly handled it badly. And it didn't work. There were no books telling them how to do this. There were no rules. But it's really not very simple. I mean, not very difficult. It's fairly simple to understand that when you pay for hostages, you simply promote the kidnapping of more people. And that's what happened. After that rather bizarre period, they went back to a policy that actually did, in the end, work. It took a long time. It took a long time, not least because of the arms for hostages incident. I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan was saying, "I will not bargain with terrorists." And all the time he's bargaining with terrorists, and they know it. And then a little while later, they say, we're not going to bargain with terrorists, and we mean it this time. It takes a while to convince the terrorists.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And that's what happened. But eventually they did believe it, and eventually they did let us go. So in the end, they got it right. We came home. We didn't pay them anything, which is about as best thing you could hope for.
Terry, I know you've become involved in New York State politics.
Mm-hmm.
And you write that even while you were held hostage, you were thinking, you know, that when you got released, you were going to get out of journalism. Why did you know then that you wanted to get out of journalism?
Well, it was an option. Look, I had a lot of time to think about things and what I had been doing and what I wanted to do and what was important. I liked journalism. I enjoyed it. It's a great deal of fun. It's exciting. It's important. I believe in what journalism contributes to free society. But the satisfactions of journalism are rather abstract. You can't point to anyone and say, I helped that person or I solved that problem. And I felt selfishly that I wanted to contribute something and see a result from that contribution. I wanted to be able to see something that I had done and say, I did that and it helped make things a little better. So I'd always been fascinated with politics, with the process of politics. And I believe in the political system. I think this is the best way we have found of handling our decisions as a society. And I think it's every citizen's obligation to take part in that political process to the extent that they possibly can. As a journalist, I couldn't. As a non-journalist, I can. And I thought about all these things, and you know, it came down to, well, we'll see when I get out if it's going to be possible to do anything else. Luckily, it is. We've got a lot of options now, thanks to an awful lot of people who have done things for us.
So are you thinking of running for office?
Not at the moment, no. I may. I'm certainly not going to sit here and say no, 1,000 times no. It may happen in the future. It's not anything I'm doing now or in the immediate future.
Terry Anderson and Madeline Basile collaborated on the new memoir, Den of Lions, about the 7 years Anderson was held hostage. This is Fresh Air. The leaders of the rebellion in Russia have been imprisoned. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have from Moscow?
We'll be hearing from NPR's Mike Schuster in Moscow about today's developments, culminating, it seems, in the taking into custody of Alexander Rutskoy, the vice president, and the chairman of parliament, Ruslan Khasbulatov. We'll also be talking with a couple of American scholars of Russian politics and a former member of the Russian parliament to hear their reactions to what's happened and what they think it portends for democratization in Russia. Also, look back at the events that led up to today's events, as well as a report from Somalia, where some fighting has claimed several American lives and Somali lives as well.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A new novel by Danish author Peter Hoag, his first to be translated into English, has generated a surprising amount of enthusiasm here. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Smilla's Sense of Snow.
Imagine Polar Star by Martin Cruz Smith, mated to Melville's Moby Dick, giving birth in the Northern Sea to calves already acquainted not only with bad weather and ulterior motives, but also colonialism, feminism, and structural anthropology. On the one hand, Smilla's Sense of Snow is a superior thriller featuring dead bodies in the frozen Arctic, corrupt science and corporate hugger-mugger in surprising Copenhagen, heroin from Southeast Asia, ex-convicts, ex-Nazis, pirate ships, and the murder on a snowy night of a 6-year-old Eskimo boy who liked at bedtime to listen to a reading aloud of Euclid's Elements. On the other hand, Smilla's Sense of Snow is also a kind of whole-earth catalog of information on an astonishing range of topics, from fossils, ice, auks, mummies, meteors, parasites, forensic medicine, and marine biology, to the relationship between Imperial Denmark and colonial Greenland. On the third hand, and in literature there's always a third hand, like a third eye or a fourth dimension, Smilla's Sense of Snow pits the creation myths, hunting habits, and space-time continuum of the Eskimo Inuits against a Western science based on calculation and hatred, on greed and fear. This is a lot to handle, even in 453 pages. Perhaps too much, unless you've got a heroine as complicated and resourceful as Peter Hoag's Smilla, a 37-year-old glacial morphologist, part-time detective, and all-round troublemaker. Smilla is up to almost anything, including violence, and has opinions on almost everything, from Karl Marx to romantic love. Das Kapital she likes, for its trembling feminine empathy and its potent indignation. Love she distrusts, because it only arises when you have a surplus. It disappears when you're reduced to the basic instincts, hunger, sleep, the need for security. She is herself a hybrid of Greenland and Europe, the deracinated daughter of an Eskimo huntress and a Danish doctor, torn from her childhood village after the disappearance of her mother, shipped off by an indifferent and embarrassed father to foster homes, private schools, cruel jokes, and race prejudice, to be civilized. Like a fossil find, or anything else that might be valuable in Greenland, she must be reported to the clerks at the Mineralogical Museum in Copenhagen, who will inform the clerks at the Institute for Metallurgy, who will decide that this precious gem is something of national interest and promptly confiscate it. While Smilla knows how to find her way over any sort of terrain, in any kind of weather, she can't go home again. Her very education, both as a second-class citizen and as a scientist, has made her too self-conscious. To want to understand, she tells us, is an attempt to recapture something we've already lost. But when a woman whose father never really wanted her loses the only child she ever really cared about, she insists on finding out why, by consulting her built-in compass, by analyzing X-rays, cracking computer codes, stowing away on icebreakers, falling from burning ships into frozen seas, and descending into an Arctic waste, where something waits that's warm and deadly. This novel, full of brilliant northern light, is itself about moral geometry. We learn that absolute space is metaphysical, that ice and snow are mother's milk.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Smilla's Sense of Snow by Peter Hoag. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Bob Balls, Chris Fraley, Joyce Lieberman, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When Lani Guinier's nomination was still in play, her opponents said she stood for racial polarization. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Guinier about her views on voting rights, views which she says were misrepresented. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.